birthplace.
Okay, I was born in Meridian, Mississippi, 1942, May 7th. Born to a minister, Methodist minister. My father was a Methodist minister. We moved quite often, and which entails most of the South. So my birthplace and the places I lived would include Yazoo City, Mississippi, Meridian, parts of Alabama, which includes Tuscaloosa, Birmingham, Decatur, Mobile, Tuskegee, and Florida, which would be Pensacola, so forth.
How was it growing up as a child?
Oh, I enjoyed it. Probably in Mississippi, I guess, in Alabama, those were enjoyable years. High school, grade school, part of the Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts coming up, part of the church. Parents were both active in the community. Excellent.
Could you tell us about your family background, your parents' name?
Okay. My father's name was Joseph Haley Griggs. My mother's maiden name was Gaines, and her full name would be Mildred Marie Gaines Griggs. Her father was a carpenter. My mother was a housewife. My father's father was a farmer, and they still own the 40 acres of land that they received after slavery in Mississippi right now, which is Scuba, Mississippi. Most of their people at that time attended college, Haven and Russ College in Mississippi, and my aunts on both sides and earned degrees and are retired teachers right now. So they were involved in education or the ministry of farming or some other work.
Could you tell us your first arrival with Champaign?
I came to Champaign in the early 60s after completing 4 years of undergrad at Arkansas A&M, which was a state black land-grant institution. Got there from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Finished high school in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and went to Arkansas for 4 years of schooling. And left Arkansas, coming to Champaign-Urbana for grad school, University of Illinois, in the early 60s.
Could you tell us the place where did you live?
My first apartment was on Chalmers. Lived over there a year. After a year, I purchased a house on Hill Street in Urbana. Lived there at 906 Hill Street, just west of Lincoln Avenue. Lived there until the early part of the 70s, 1970. And then we bought another home and moved south of town.
How does the black community, as far as your experience differ from when you first came in today's time?
I guess when I first moved to Champaign-Urbana, it was a totally segregated community. No open housing policy at that time. They were having problems in downtown Champaign. At JCPenney's and I think Sears, people were picketing the stores. My wife worked at Penney's for a while after that, while she was in grad school. All of the black people lived north of University Avenue and west of Lincoln Avenue and east of Neal, and I would say the majority of blacks at that time. The ones that I knew that didn't live in those areas were long-time residents of the community, like Hester Suggs' parents and Gene Suggs' parents, which lived just a couple of blocks south of University Avenue. Ozella Kelka and Tella, I'm trying to think of Tella's last name, Tella Thomas, moved out east of town to build their homes because of segregation and real estate during that time. Now there's a drastic change in terms of housing, a drastic change in terms of jobs, drastic change in terms of black involvement in the community. So there's been progress, especially in housing. Almost every community in Champaign-Urbana now would be integrated. In terms of job responsibilities, there were very few blacks in responsible roles, professional roles. Now there are many in city government, in the public schools, in the university, and even professional people. At the time I first moved here, there was no black lawyer. There are several now, about a half a dozen in town. No black dentist at the time. And at the time, didn't have a black doctor. We've seen two or three black doctors go through the town. There's a black dentist in town, and lawyers, and other professional blacks. So there's been some progress.
How did the Civil Rights Movement affect you personally or affect the community?
Well, I lost my scholarship going through the Civil Rights Movement. I grew up in it. I was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama when Arthurine Lucy tried to integrate the University of Alabama. At that time, the city was under curfew. I was also in high school when Dr. King started the movement in Montgomery, and I was also arrested in Montgomery during that time. Went on to Arkansas and participated in demonstration against the governor. I lost my athletic scholarship at the time, but got it back. Moved to Champaign, and I guess I got involved in so many things here, which included some of the movements in town with the Urban League, some of the movements on campus, some of the things in the public schools, and that's how I ended up at Champaign Centennial High School, because of the riots involved out there. So I don't seem like I can get away from that quite as it's kept. So, in terms of Champaign, I don't think the movement was as strong as the black college campuses, where we had to endure a lot of hardship. Urbana was just a march downtown for jobs and things like that. But was involved in the Douglas Center problems too, with the new center. Worked at Douglas Center for a number of years in the 60s when Mr. Williams was director in Booker Ford, and they were going through the problems of trying to establish a new center. So we did some demonstration at the Park District office. So I've been somewhat involved in the Champaign-Urbana civil rights movement, and equal rights movement, open housing, things like that.
Did crime after, you know, the civil rights movement, or the latter part of it, did crime in the black community decrease or increase from your viewpoint?
I think it's increased, but I don't think it's related to the civil rights movement at all. I think crime now, as we see it, is all over the community, not just in the black community. But crime is a part of our nation and our world. Crime increased in Champaign-Urbana because of drugs, and only drugs, not because of civil rights or anything else. If you notice the crime that we have now, the burglaries or the armed robberies, the killings, you would find some indirect or direct correlation between drugs, narcotics. Whether it's robbing to purchase, robbing to take drugs, whether taking territory. So it's all drug related, not related to the civil rights movement, nor the progress of blacks. In some ways, it's been a crime, that type of crime has been a detriment to the progress of the community. And I say the community because it affects the whole community, not just the black community.
What was your first job when you came to
Pentagon? Oh, my first job was at a Hayes School. You know where that is? That's now Martin Luther King School. I started working there with Henry Mears, and John Buster was the principal then, and Ozella Kelka was also a fourth grade teacher there. That was my first teaching job in Champaign-Urbana.
Could you give us all the jobs that you've had since then?
Let me start with that job at Hayes School, the Urbana Park District, the University of Illinois, University of Illinois instructor in the fitness program in the phys ed department, the Champaign Park District, Unit 4 schools. I taught at Gregory, which is now closed, Marquette, which is now closed, Washington Elementary School, which is open, and a magnet school, and that was before they integrated the Unit 4 schools, Centennial High School, which is, I served as a football coach, assistant football coach, head track coach, head cross country coach, Champaign Park District, I guess I mentioned that, and then at Edison Middle School presently, other jobs I've had since I've been here, and other odds and ends. I own a business, so I guess you say I work for myself, Colony Square Cleaners also.
Okay, could you tell us names of the organizations or clubs that you've been a member of in the past or still a member of?
Yeah, I will try. One would be Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, which was start of the Cotillion Ball that presently is in Champaign-Urbana, which is a service fraternity. The next would be the Urban League, long-standing member involved in this youth movement back in the 60s all the way up until the 80s as board president. The CETA program, PIC, Private Industry Council, serving as the chairperson of that, and the chairperson of the council now. Family Service Board Member, Title VII Board Member, which is Unit 4 Schools. Member of the National Association of Secondary School Principals, a member of the Illinois Principals Association, member of National Curriculum, ACDC, which is American Curriculum Organization, National Curriculum Organization. Several professional organizations, and that's about it. I can think of.
Okay, could you tell us a little bit about how you started the cotillion and why?
Oh, that's a long story. I guess, and I didn't start it on my own. There's several fraternity brothers involved, which includes Willie T. Somerville, Bob Wilson, Theopolis Harrington, and several other fraternity brothers that are now removed from the city. I guess the idea came up from observing young black people in the community and not seeing a viable activity for young black girls. And at the time, we saw a need for such an organization, such an activity, because of the things that we saw black youth getting involved in. And I think that during that time was an onslaught of young black ladies having early having children in their early ages, and not really being actively involved in the school activities, high school activities. What we tried to institute was a event, or some type of event at the end of their high school career that would motivate them to work hard academically and to strive for some type of achievement, and to also avoid that pitfall of having kids at an early age, which can be very damaging to them in the future, which can be a detriment to them, a yoke. And so we work to do that. It's similar to the balls in the South. Basically, they have them all over. A coming out type of affair. They have them in town, but usually at the country clubs. And they have them also in the Jewish church, in the temple, if you're familiar with the type of ceremony they have for the young Jewish kids coming of age. Basically, that's what it is. And we took off on that idea because there was a need. We didn't realize at the time, being males, that we couldn't handle such a deal. It outgrew us, and we felt very threatened by picking up young ladies at night and driving around in the cars. And so we decided that we'd look for a lady organization. We looked for several sororities, and then we finally asked some of the ladies in the community to help us, which included Catherine Humphrey, Margaret Smith, Jean Davis, and some more ladies in the community. And we began to really back out of it then, after they got themselves on the ground, knew the ropes of the organization. And it's been a very successful thing since then. In fact, every year it continues to grow. And it's something that was needed. Was a place for it, and it's serving its purpose.
What year was this?
Oh, I think it was 1970 or 71. I have all the booklets, but I think the first one was 1971. So it's been going on about 10 years or more.
Have the objectives of the cotillion been the same?
Basically the same. Quiet as is kept, scholarship, academic performance, and I would hate to, with all the feminist movement, get into the other parts of it. It can show some conflicts now, but yes, I think it's the same. Bringing young black ladies out and being recognized for their achievements, and it's serving its purpose. It's also had a family tie into it too. And we tried to avoid that because there are some pitfalls there. Because a lot of black families, you don't have the total family. And we recognized that from the start. But we were hoping that it would bring the families closer together too, where the father, or the brother, or the uncle would present the young lady. If not, in some cases, sponsored. We had sponsors that would sponsor the young ladies. But in most cases, the mothers were involved, or the brothers, or the sisters. involved in the whole thing. So it turned out to be a family type affair, and where people just bought, family members bought tickets. They were involved in the advertising of the event, and they participated. But we had tried to avoid saying you have to have your father to present you, because we knew at the time that the structure of the black family is a little different in our world, which isn't bad, but it's different. And a lot of relatives really didn't have a sponsor or father to pay that money. So we found sponsors at the time with money. When we first started, we found individuals in the community with $50 or $60 willing to sponsor a girl. So I would say that the structure of it is about the same today. Nothing has changed, really changed, except for maybe the scholarship money.
Has there ever been an effort to get maybe organization for the Young Boys?
Well, we thought about that, but if you notice, black males, I'm sure you've noticed that they tend to function quite well in the schools and the community. They're able to cross lines very easily into the white society, white community, and back into the black community. We didn't see a real problem with the males other than academic work in the high schools. They just would not work hard in the classroom, which was a put down to them working hard, because we saw black students putting each other down when they performed in the classroom. But that was the only problem. A lot of black males participated in sports and things, and they had white friends. They did quite well. In fact, they dated white girls. I'm quite sure you're aware of that, which took some of your guys away from you. And that's, we knew that for black males, it wasn't a real threat to them in the community, and they could survive it. We were worried about the females that were left totally out of a social picture, and they still are somewhat. With girls' sports, things are changing now. They're getting involved in sports now. With the boys, we did include them in the escorts and the dance routines and things like that, so they were a part anyway. And during that time, we chose the fellas and had a reservoir or a group on hand for the girls to select from. You need an escort, we suggest that you don't get your boyfriend, because you may fall out a week before the cotillion, and all this is a way for him to get even with you and quit on you, and you don't have an escort. So we suggest that you pick someone out this pool, a brother or uncle. We suggested that, which is the best way to go. So we didn't start anything for the black males. We didn't feel it was necessary, not whether they had the time with them involved in sports so much. Our biggest concern was academic work, and we found a solution for that. Didn't find a solution, but we found something for that.
Okay, getting back to the continuum with the girls, when they first started it, did they lean towards the grade point average more, or community involvement, all that together? Because I know when I was in it, they didn't really.
It was a struggle. It was a struggle because you got into a lot of political games. Some girls were highly community involved and didn't have the grade point average, but someone in the community pushed them very hard to get them in. We had a lot of girls high academically with the grade point average, but didn't care to get involved in it. So it was a combination of things. We did tend to stress that more and more and wanted to hang on to it. At one point, we almost lost the grade point average. Someone wanted to kick it out, said it was just too much and we were losing a lot of good girls because of grade point average. But that was important to us. If you go with three or four girls with the grade point average, and we're talking about C+, we're not talking about A's or B's, we're talking about C+. We didn't see anything wrong with holding on to a C+. So we attempted to hold on to it. Now the ladies wanted to reduce that, and we said no, we wanted to hold on to it. But I don't know where it is right now. We have enough black females now and males with a C plus or better to fill that every year. Because I don't think it's a problem now.
Do you think that having this motivates the young girls to want to try harder in school?
Yes. I think back then, and I don't know the trend now, I would think with the feminist movement, it may be a way of stepping out of it. I don't know how they feel about that. I don't think that movement is affecting the black community as the white community, though. I would say it was a motivating factor. A lot of girls were out there looking forward to this, their senior year, and it was something better than the prom. So I would say, sure, it was a motivating factor.
Are youth in today's time more motivated than you first came?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Young people, black youth, they've improved so much. The number going to college, the number involved in activities, the number involved in the community is so great now that it's unbelievable. When I first moved to the community, you could count the number of kids going to college on your hand. In fact, it was disturbing to me to see very few leave the high schools going on to college. Now, I would say over 50 or 60% of your black youth coming out of high school are going on to some type of educational program beyond high school. So, yes, youth today, they're sharper, too. They have more on the ball. They're getting more out of the education system.
Where do youth get their motivation from?
I think role models, basically. When I first moved to Champaign-Urbana, you think about the number of black postmen, professional people, teachers, administrators, zero. And then you start thinking about the ones that are here now, lawyers, doctors. Young people can see the progress. I have a chance. You know, although the jobs are hard to come by today for them, but they still see some hope and some light at the end of the tunnel. Back then, it was difficult to see. I never thought I could be an engineer when I was growing up. I didn't see any black engineers. I saw black teachers, and that's what I headed into. Now you don't have to be a teacher. You can be an engineer, you can be a doctor, you can be a dentist, you can be a lawyer. So you have the role models now, and that's very important in a community. You need the proper role models, and when you have them, it works. You may not think so when you're in high school or when you're in grade school. But when you get out, you can look back, because I see my black principal now. I never thought I was going to be a principal. But now, when I see McDonald Hughes at my high school, I see that big black man standing there. And I would say he inspired me to do something. And so it was to continue to go to school. Just his presence, saying that, hey, you got a chance to do it too. I watched those, and like the guys watch the pro basketball on TV. They see those guys playing basketball and they think about being basketball players. And they had those role models on the floor. And the same thing with baseball, same thing with football, same thing with a black doctor. You see that guy working, you think, by George, that's what I want to be. And eventually, you will have some black kids from Champaign, Urbana, in the medical profession, if you don't already have some. If you look hard enough, you probably have some. But you will have some. And they may not come back to Champaign, Urbana to practice, but you will have some. But I think the role models make the difference.
What kind of things have you encountered as principal or associate principal at Edison?
What type of things I've encountered? Oh, so many. You talking about in terms of the community, as a black person, as a...
In all aspects.
Oh, gee, what I've encountered. You, as administrator, you encounter everything. I guess the most positive thing I can think about be helping students grow, and also building a program Those are positive things. Putting ideas in and seeing those ideas work, your ideas, which is one thing everyone gets some type of satisfaction out of. The other thing is to see youth mature and grow. I go back to my role as a coach and assistant principal at Centennial. I've seen people come through, young people come through. They are professional people now, and they come back and they stop and they talk, and I'm doing such and such. Those are the things you encounter that are positive. I think there are a lot of negative things, like the political games that are now in education. Those are the negative things that I don't enjoy, because it gets in the way of education. And it's there are a lot of politics now involved in public education. I don't like particularly like that. I hate to work with the same old problems over and over and over, where you're continually trying to improve something and you see no progress. And I can give you some examples dealing with discipline problems that you hope would drive and fly away, you know, but they don't. One discipline problem leaves at the end of the year, another one comes in. And you would like to live in a perfect world where students come in and like a sponge and soak up education and leave, but you don't get that. You know, that's what you hope for and wish for. Getting that education is the needs of the child, basically what I was saying. That interferes with my thinking. I come to school and I'm not properly fed or properly clothed, and I can't think education. And I think those are the negative points I see in education. I see it every day. Those are the ills of society that I can't deal with and I can't solve, but it interferes with my program. Johnny's mother isn't working, and no job, or poor housing, and we know it's affecting the child and the family. Something I have no control over, and it affects my program, it affects me as an administrator, but it's nothing I can do. And those are the negative points I see in my job and things I encounter all the time. There's so many movements and shifts going on in the community that deals with education that is unbelievable. And now we're having a board race in Champaign, and probably the same thing will happen in Urbana, that people are making moves already to move people out. And they're for minor, petty, little interest groups, not thinking about the total educational program, but we want to close down this school, or we want to open this school, or we're not going to let this school close. And I'm getting on the board just for that interest, not thinking about the total community. That's the sad part about the public school. And that's why we're not going to grow the way we should grow, because of that. So I've encountered a lot of things. I've learned a lot of things. But you always, as a black person, wonder whether you can run a building or a school building or any other type of job till you get in and you find out it's not difficult at all. Fairly simple. If the people will allow you to run it. People get in your way every day and try to interfere, disrupt. And that includes students and staff and also community people. And it comes for a lot of reasons. Edison was a building that they used to close down Franklin, and they sent a lot of poor kids to Edison. Edison served the wealthy part of Champaign, which was a white predominant area, south area, Windsor Park, Devonshire, and other parts of that community. When they closed Franklin down, a lot of people in that inner town didn't want it to succeed, because they didn't want the poor part of the community coming to Edison. I knew that when I got the job. The superintendent knew that. The computer people knew that. It was my thing to get it going right and to make sure these two communities work together well. And a lot of people say it's not going to work. You know, those kids are never going to get along. If you leave the kids alone, they will get along. And they did. And they are getting along. But still there are people out there trying to stop that progress. So those are the things you encounter. Those are the things you have to deal with. Those things get in the way in educating people and kids. So if you ask me what I encounter a lot of stuff. a lot of stuff that's not even connected to educating young people.
Are parents more involved with the children than when you first came when you were teaching the school?
That's a fallacy. Parents always been involved with their kids. I hate to hear people say that. Parents not interested. They are not involved. I don't care who they are. There are parents in the community that are wealthy, that can stay at home. They don't have to work, and they can come to the school every minute. Okay? But there's a parent who's out there working and care more than that parent that's staying at home. But I can't get that because I have to work and feed Jordan when he gets home. But I can't come over there, you know. And they care. But it's the position that they're in and what the resources they have to show that type of caring. So all parents care about the welfare of their kids, about the growth and development of their child. But there may be something interfering with that to show that. Maybe a job, it may be family problems, maybe housing, it may be a number of things. But parents care, and they've always cared. My mother cared, my father cared, but it was a different way of showing it. And they just couldn't drive over in their nice car, park it, get out, come up to the school, and sit and chat and say, you know, I want Johnny to have this subject or that subject. And some of it entails education, too. Some parents feel uncomfortable coming because they're not educated. And some of the school officials and school staff put pressure on them by their language, the way they address them, and put them down. They feel uncomfortable. So they tend to stay away, but they care. They've always cared. I haven't seen a parent yet that didn't care. They may not show it. They may be upset with the child, but if you you mistreat that child, you'll find out. They come out of that bag then. So, yeah, they care, and they've always cared. There's no difference now than 50 years. And Mother Nature put that in a mother, whether you know it or not. Mothers are just natural caring people, whether it's for their child or for their husband or for people, period. Now, I would say Mother Nature didn't put that much in a male of caring. For some reason, we can go to war and kill each other. And I don't think mothers could do that. You know, they're too loving and too caring. But they care. Okay. That's a long sermon on that one.
What would you suggest as a solution to this problem between parents and the teachers, administrators? What do you think should be done?
There are a lot of solutions to it. One is that communication should be open all the time. Total communication. Each end. The parents should feel comfortable in calling the teacher. The teacher should feel comfortable in calling the parent. And that should be established early. And the school should establish that. Teachers should get on the phone and say, hey, all letters should be sent home. If you're having the problems, call. Or an administrator. There should be meetings, conferences, time set aside that will accommodate working parents plus those parents that are not working, like evening conferences, and we do that now. We don't hold all our conferences from 8 to 5. We will hold one on Thursday from 7 to 9, and then the next day from 8 to 12, which will allow working parents to come in from 7 to 9, and then those parents are free to come in from 8 to 12 the next day. So we do that. We put instituted programs where we have what we call parent aids. Parents in the community come in, we have those that are familiar with the community, and they work with parents in the community, those who can communicate with people. We wouldn't dare send some teachers out in the community. They wouldn't know how to act. Tied up in their own world. They would not even address some parents. So we use aids to extend that communication. We have phone calls, we make home visits, we encourage staff members to make home visits. When I went to Hayes, one thing Mr. Buster said, John said, Albert, before the semester's over, if you have to make two home visits to all your parents. I had about 30 kids in my classroom. And before the end of the semester and then to each home twice. And they don't do that anymore. They don't do that because the contract said I don't have to go. So I'm not going. But it was a good thing then. And a lot of schools are getting back to that. We expect for you to go out. I make home visits all the time. I made one last night, first day of school. Drove out to Bradley McKinley and chatted with a young man. He had some trouble getting in Central High School. I was there. He called me up and I told him I'd be over so the school was out. So we do those things which are important, and you have to sometimes meet your public. Yeah? And you have to understand why they don't meet you all the time and not put them down for not being bright enough, financially well off enough to take care of those needs. So there are a lot of things you can do. And they are simple. They're not costly items. They're little simple things that you can do to extend that that warmth, that caring from the school to the home. And it can be even in the child. You know, the biggest publicity, advertising agent that you have in the school is that child. And if you mistreat him, he's going to put you down. If you treat him right, and if you're warm to him, if you're caring, he's going to say something good about the school. But if he leaves there, think, oh, God, those are a bunch of rum-dums, you know. And that's going to hurt you more than anything. But sometimes you have to do that with some kids now. You can't always pat them on the back. You have to spank them on the tail sometimes, too. But, you know, still students understand that, too. They understand this. And there are some schools that are not warm. There are some schools that are cold, and not just to black kids, to kids in the community, period. And we have to learn to be warm and caring.
I was wondering about Addis. I don't know very much about it, but you have courses. You have courses that prepare the child for, you know, high school and future.
Yeah, out of the middle school, coming out of the high school, and I spent 10 years at the high school, and so I'm quite familiar with the high school. And coming back to middle school, basic. What we prepare them for, the basic skills. We stress that, the reading, the writing, and the math. And if we get a child at a certain grade level in reading, math, and grammar, and English composition, we then know that child will succeed in high school. For example, if we can get him to an eighth grade level in math, get him to a seventh or eighth grade level in reading, coming out of middle school, he's going to perform quite well at high school. Shouldn't be any problem. If he comes out of reading at the fourth or fifth grade level, we know he's going to have problems. So what we work very hard to do is to get him to a level of basic skills. And then we go from there. We can turn him loose anywhere then. If you, at age 13 or 14, can read at an eighth grade level, you're okay. Because you're thinking about now the average adult reads about junior high level. So he's reading what the national average would, all the people in America, the average comes out to about eighth grade level. So he's performing quite well. And if you can get him to handle his math, that's no problem. Now when you talk about other things. You know, we work at the mill, I do. With the Upward Bound program, we had several kids in the Upward Bound program this year from Edison. In fact, we had about 7 or 8. And in the Principal Scholars program, we had 2 or 3. So we've been pushing that at the middle school level. Get them started early, so when they get to the high school, they come on as a freshman with the idea that I know I'm going to be in a program, I know where I'm going, I know what I want to do. And I know what courses to take. I know I need that language. I know I need the math. I know I need the science and the English composition. So they got that down pat, and they know where they're going. Now, in terms of careers, we have a career program that's taught by the counseling department, also taught by the science teacher. And at the end of their eighth grade year, they will get that package program of careers, what type of careers, what they offer, how you prepare yourself for. So yes, we do You have to bridge that gap. You just can't leave the junior high, high school level and say, this is what we're going to teach. We're not going to worry about that high school or college program. If you do that, there will be no connection, and kids will be left out there alone.
I can't just
feel
myself, because, you know, like a lot of students that get into high school, they don't know, well, they bypass the things that they need in junior high.
Mm-hmm.
And learning really starts younger,
yes,
younger age.
Yes, you know, basic skills, right. And if they can get that, they're on their way. Because basically, once you get to high school, you've got basically all your basic skills should be intact. And you should branch out to your higher math, your different types of English and lit, and your different subject areas, your drafting, your anatomy, physiology. You're not going to get a lot of reading in high school. You'll get different types of reading, but you're not going to get reading skills. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that many black children today use more cop-outs, you know, as far as, you know, education is concerned?
I have to compare that to past years and say that I've seen a drastic change in the direction of black youth in today's society. And I have to compare my high school career to that and say you see very few black kids copping out. What you will see is black kids struggling, trying to make it, and there are other things in the way that's preventing them from dealing with the situation, such as family background or jobs or everything related to money, basically, if you look at education. This world now is not going to be a racial thing. Down the road, it's going to be a socioeconomic type of thing. And that's what it's getting to be now. You see those kids who can't cope with that copping out. And they cop out because they know they can't cope. At the middle school level, you see your social groups beginning to develop. And I can point them out now, the second day of school at Edison. You see your social groups that are from nice middle-class families begin to polarize each other. They have friends, they eat together in the cafeteria. Those kids who are involved in drama, band, they're doing it not because of their interests. They're doing it because their parents directed them in that direction. And then you see the poor kid, whether black or white, and you have a lot of poor whites in Champaign, Urbana, especially at the school I am in. You see those poor black kids, poor white kids being left out. Then you begin to see them copping out. Then they figure, they begin to get the picture. Hey, I don't see it. I don't have the money to buy that horn. I don't have the money to have the social parties. I don't have the money to wear those clothes, or Izark shirts, or the Vans shoes. I don't know whether you've seen those shoes that they wear. Tennis shoes that you pay $35, $40 for, and some of them are the jogging shoes too. And they begin to figure that out. And then they begin to take a different role. And they begin to get attention, to seek attention by other methods. And what you call copping out, what I call dealing with their way of coping with the situation. They either turn to alcohol, they either turn to drugs, they either turn to violence. And then sometimes they will just abstain from everything, just move themselves away from just everything and just be themselves. Or they get with a group that like certain things and they just, you see them copping out. But that's not copping out. That's beginning to recognize your place, and it's not that way, but beginning to recognize the place that society put you in, and you begin to assume that role. And That's what's happening when you see a copping out. There are some wealthy kids that will deal with the world the same way. They see their parents working hard, not enjoying themselves, busting their butt to make the dollar. Son of a medical doctor. And he obviously the family unhappy, the mother unhappy, or that he may be unhappy with his father because of the lack of attention or time. And he may cop out too, but he's got all the money. He's saying, hey, I don't want to be like that dude. He doesn't love me or my mother. And so he begins to cop out too. So you have to go back and find the underlying cause for the behavior of an individual. And that behavior can come to be caused by a number of things in society. So I wouldn't call it copping out. I begin to call sometimes survival and coping. I don't think alcohol is direction to go, or drugs would be the direction to go. But that's the choice they made. And that's their way of dealing with this world. I'll be honest with you, a lot of them try to go the suicide route now. So some decide, I'm not going to deal with it and just don't want to live in this world. And they take their own life. But I don't think it's copping out. And they'll tell you, well, why should I work hard? I'm not going to get a job. I won't be able to go to college, you know. But they need to learn that there's always a chance, and they need to be given that, I guess, that feeling that you can always make it, that you don't give up, you keep trying. You know, had our forefathers given up in slavery and said, hey, you know, like the American Indians, and they did, they gave up. Just wouldn't decide to fight it. And they just wiped them off the face of the earth. Had we done the same thing, they would have wiped us off the face of the earth. So we didn't give up. We kept trying, we kept working, we kept thinking, we kept moving, and, you know, thinking there's hope. And I think black people are motivated to that type of thing. But we lose a few on the way, but we can't save them all.
All right, teachers more sensitive to the child than in the past, or what's the difference?
I don't think there's a dirt change in the needs, I guess the sensitivity of the teacher. I think there's a change in the educational level of staff people now. And I would say after the 70s, the people going into education now are not your top college people. Those people who are bright and sharp are going into medicine, business, and engineering, other fields where they can make more money. I think what you're seeing in education today are young people getting away from teaching. And they're getting away from it because of the lack of funds, the lack of control. And what I mean by control, school districts are controlled now by the public, and people aren't going to get involved in all that politics and all the stuff you have to go through now. So what you see now is a different type of teacher. I think the sensitivity is the same, but I think the educational level or the intelligence of that individual may be a little different, where in past years you've had the very, very bright, sharp people in education. We will get back to that eventually. We will get back to getting sharp people in education. But I didn't encourage my son to get an education. He's at the university now, and I did not encourage him to get into education, although he wanted to be a coach. Told me he's crazy. And I encouraged him to go into engineering. And he's not in engineering now. He's in industrial design because he loves art and artwork. I did not encourage him to go into education. He can come out in industrial design, get a job in industry somewhere, probably starting off with $20,000, where starting off as a teacher, he'll get 12 or 13. So that's what you're seeing, the change in education. But I think teachers are sensitive. I think people are sensitive to the needs of people. Sometimes there's nothing they can do about it. And I think there are people in the field now that are following the contract. And the union contract says that you work from 7:30 to 3:15, 3:15 and go home. Now that's the way society is turning now. Everybody works by a contract, and education is into it. When you start dealing with human beings, you can't work by a contract. Any type of humane organization or structure You don't work by a clock. You work by the needs of the individual. And when you get into working by contracts, you begin to interfere with the needs and not think what you're saying about sensitivity. Those people are sensitive to those needs, but they're also looking at that clock and thinking about that contract. And they say you follow the contract. You know, if you don't follow the contract, you begin to get, for example, all the cuts you've had in Champaign and Urbana, you will still find teachers working just as hard with more kids, fewer dollars, and you will see them even make the system operate with less. And they've been doing it to teachers for years. Teachers have been the lowest people on the totem pole. They're the people that they couldn't socialize in the community. They would fire you if they caught you in a bar. In fact, they wouldn't hire one of the football coaches at Centennial because he was hanging out at the locker room. I don't know whether you remember reading that in the paper this summer. That's the type of people they want. They want a nice, good at two shoes and other professions. You can do your thing. You can wear a mustache, you can wear this, you can do that, you can go places. But for years they wanted the people they thought at times because of their action, good moral upbringing and standards and values, and they put some teachers on the spot. But the teachers are changing that now. I think the profession will get better.
What church do you attend?
My wife is a member of Bethel. Let me give you my long story. Since my father was a Methodist minister, he burned me out on the church. I lived next door to the church. I went every day. My grandfather was a deacon in the Baptist church. My mother played the piano. And by the time I got 16, 17 years old, and I said, if I get away from home, I'll never go back to church. I didn't really say that, but that's the way I felt. And he was a United Methodist minister. There's no United Methodist Black Church in Champaign-Urbana. There's a couple on campus. They don't need my money. So I will go to Bethel with my wife and family when they go. And basically that's the only place we attend. Occasionally we'll go to church on campus. And when I go stay with my mother, we'll go to, she lives in Tacoma, Washington. We'll go to her church in Tacoma, Washington, which is the United Methodist, and she's the only black face in the church. But we go, and I sit there, and I enjoy the service, the same service. But in the South, they split off. The two churches split off. Black ministers left the white United Methodist Church and formed their own United Methodist. And then the AME and CME Church split off from the United Methodist Church. And they started their own group. So there are three splinter groups of the Methodist Church, AME, CME, and United. United has been the South. Now it's back to integration now. They are predicting down the road in the next 100 years that AME and CME will be back together, and then they will merge back with the United Methodist. One reason is because of retirement and funds. They're drying up in the churches now, and so you'll see a lot of consolidation in churches. And that's a guess, and that's what I've been reading, and that's what the black churches in the South are doing now, because they do get good benefits from the large body that they used to be with back after slavery, but they are back now, and they do get excellent benefits, ministers.
Oh, yeah. What's your wife's name?
Mildred.
What's her name?
Her maiden name is Mildred Barnes.
Yeah. When did you get married?
Early, when I was a sophomore in college. She was a senior, so we married in undergrad in Arkansas. She's from Arkansas, a small town in Arkansas. Her father was a cotton farmer, had 13 kids, and sent every one of them to college. Didn't have an education. In fact, I don't think he finished grade school, and that's about all, because he was a superman. She's in town. She's a professor, full professor at the university, has a PhD, She just finished serving as the president of a national organization, which is American Home Economics Association, which hosts about 4,000 members nationwide and nationally too. She served on national company and boards. She wrote for JCPenney's in the educational department, and also she structured and put together the state curriculum for home economics about a year ago, and now she's working on another project. So she's a super person.
How many children do you have?
Two boys. That's enough.
What are they?
Paul and Scott.
Did your wife come here before you did?
We came together. Okay. She had a fellowship at the university. We moved here. And then her goal in the undergrad before we got married was she was going back to school. She enjoyed school all the way through first grade. In fact, she started school early, first grade. Started school at age 4 or 5. And that's why she finished ahead of me. And she was in college and finishing before I got to my junior year. And that's because she started early. So she, when she finished undergrad, she wanted to go back to grad school. She knew that, and she was an excellent student. So we both moved here, we both got into grad school, we both got our master's, and she did quite well in the master's program, so they invited her back to work on her EDD, and she completed that. And after she completed that, they asked her to stay and work. So she built a home for herself in the education building. And she's on the athletic board right now, and she's on the college executive committee, which carries a lot of weight in both departments. Being on the athletic board is quite powerful, because she's making decisions for the athletic department. And being on the executive board, she makes decisions on salaries for her peers. So she's overly involved. Community in school.
Has your wife influenced you?
I think we have a good mix. We influence each other. We are supportive of each other, and it works both ways. Yes, she's had some influence on me, and I hope I've had some influence on her. She's never been outside of Arkansas before I moved outside of Arkansas. She's never eaten fish or seafood before I purchased it for her. So we had influence on each other. We've been good. I lived in a big city. I knew the ropes. I knew how to, I was streetwise. She lived in a small town. She knew the workings of a small community, and how families should be structured and how to live and preserve your life. And so that influence rubbed off of me, and I've shared some of my street wisdom with her and some of my savvy. I don't know whether it's been good, but I think it's yes, we've had influence with each other.